Hello, it's John Dennis here on Wednesday, the 7th of January. Today, the new head of MI5 says Israel's attack on Gaza may push some British Muslims towards Islamist extremism.
He goes through all the countries in a way. He says, look, like certainly foreign policy and foreign events affects the young, you know, Muslims here or potential extremists here.
Also today, diplomatic efforts to halt Israel's bombardment of Gaza intensify as the number of civilians killed rises sharply.
They are saying very clearly now that they must have something that will stop Hamas rearming. And that involves quite a complex diplomatic arrangement that needs to be put in place.
And you wait years for a bus with an atheist slogan on the side, and then 800 come along at once.
It is a most astonishing thing that if you say something religious, that's fine. But if you say something much milder that's non-religious, you're strident and shrill. We are not strident and shrill.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But before we hear about any of that, here's Sandy Waugh with the news headlines and a look at the papers.
Israel says it's agreed to set up a humanitarian corridor to ship vital supplies to the people of the Gaza Strip. Under the plan put forward by its defence ministry, Israel would suspend attacks in certain areas to allow people to get supplies. In a statement, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert says the goal is to prevent a humanitarian crisis in the Gaza Strip. Israel insists it has allowed enough supplies into the territory during 11 days of conflict, but the UN says there are already shortages of food, fuel and medicine. And we'll be hearing from The Guardian's Middle East editor later in the programme. The head of MI5 says the threat of an immediate attack by Al-Qaeda-inspired extremists has diminished because of a string of successful prosecutions. But Jonathan Evans is warning leaders of Al-Qaeda still intend to mount a campaign, and there are individuals in Britain able to do so. It's the first newspaper interview by a serving MI5 Director General and comes on the centenary of the establishment of the security service. Evans also suggesting the situation in Gaza is giving extremists in Britain more ideological ammunition. There's more on this with our security editor in just a moment. Struggling high street giant Marks & Spencer is expected to cut more than 1,000 jobs today. Analysts predict the firm will reveal plunging food and merchandise sales, despite slashing prices several times last month. Union leaders are warning the retailer it could face a series of employment tribunal cases if it announces a huge number of job losses. Hopes of eradicating measles from Europe by 2010 may have been dashed by poor vaccination rates in a handful of countries, including Britain. A study has documented more than 12,000 cases in 2006 and 2007. All but 15% occurred in just five countries: the UK, Germany, Switzerland, Italy and Romania, and most were infections of unvaccinated or partially vaccinated children. In Britain, a slump in the take-up of the vaccine has been blamed on unfounded fears about the possible side effects of the MMR jab. And Spurs have one foot in the Carling Cup final after a 4-1 win over Burnley at White Hart Lane. The North London club came back from being 1-0 down at half-time. Look at this morning's papers now. The Independent focuses on what it calls the massacre of innocents as a UN school in Gaza is shelled. The Telegraph has a different take on the interview with the head of MI5, saying the global economic crisis will add to the security threat facing Britain. The paper also reports on how drivers of gas-guzzling cars will have to pay more for parking. The FT looks at how one of Germany's wealthiest men committed suicide because of the credit crunch. Adolf Merkel had had weeks of talks with creditors designed to save his businesses from being consumed by disastrous investments. There's also a piece on Apple's iTunes announcements. The first is that it will now allow songs to be sold for different prices rather than the standard 79p. The second is how record labels have agreed to drop restrictions which prevent tracks from being copied. The new Cold War makes the front of the Express, saying Britain is bracing itself for gas price hikes and shortages after Europe was caught up in the energy war between Russia and Ukraine. And the Mail calls it the Great Light Bulb Revolt. The paper says Britons are finally waking up to the fact their beloved light bulb will disappear for good after 120 years. Retailers are no longer replenishing stocks of the traditional 100-watt bulb. More on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
Jonathan Evans is the new head of the security service MI5. He's spearheading the fight against terrorism in the UK. And he's told The Guardian that the threat of an immediate attack in Britain by Al-Qaeda-inspired extremists has diminished because a string of successful prosecutions has made potential terrorists think twice. But he said Al-Qaeda leaders intend to attack Britain and there are individuals here able to do so. Our security editor, Richard Norton Taylor, says it's the first time a serving head of MI5 has spoken to journalists.
It's to mark the 100th anniversary of setting up MI5, 1909, although it wasn't until later in the year. And as Jonathan Evans, the Director General of MI5, said, it's a part of the kind of route towards greater transparency and openness of the security service.
His predecessor, Eliza Manningham Buller, warned of a growing and serious threat of terrorism to the UK. What's Jonathan Evans' view?
Well, also Jonathan Evans, in his first speech, as opposed to interview with the newspaper, about a year ago, actually said a similar thing, saying that Al-Qaeda are doing all sorts of nasty things, recruiting even teenagers. But today he told us that, in his first interview, he told us that actually Al-Qaeda seems to have peaked, at least. He put it this way. He says that the threat is not as great. It seems to be not as great as it was, certainly on the question of late-stage attacks, which means that they don't think anyone's about to do an immediate attack in Britain. But, of course, there are people there with ability and capability to do so, and there are people there who are sympathetic still with Al-Qaeda. But he sort of played it down, really, which is actually quite significant and also rather different to ministers, I say sometimes rather hysterically, actually, but ministers, you know, who do have recently, Home Office ministers and other ministers, have pitched up that, you know, Al-Qaeda terrorist threat. It's obviously in their interest to do so. But I think it's his, Jonathan Evans is a particularly rather cool person. Also, he says that in the end of the day, and that's what MI5 says, there's not such a thing as perfect security. There may well be another terrorist attack. We're doing our best. There's not 100% security, which ministers, of course, don't like to hear, but rather sort of, well, the professionals in the security intelligence world, as in Jonathan Evans, paints a rather calmer, more sanguine picture.
What effect does Jonathan Evans think the recent high-profile prosecutions of terrorists have had on potential terrorist attacks?
Well, he thinks that, he looks back and says, you know, one of the reasons why the terrorist threat may not be as bad as it was precisely because of our great work, he says, the work of MI5, the police, the Director of Public Prosecutions, who brings people to trial, 86, I think, significant terrorist suspects brought to trial since January 07, half of those pleaded guilty. That, he says, has had a chilling effect.
And what effect does he think the Israeli bombardment of Gaza might have on potential Islamist extremism?
Yeah, he says, like, he goes through all the countries in a way. He says, look, like, certainly foreign policy and foreign events affects the young, you know, Muslims here or potential, you know, extremists here.
It sounds obvious, but I mean, Tony Blair didn't.
But Blair denied it. He says whenever people have said, you know, foreign policy is completely relevant. Now, of course, it may not be an excuse for terrorist acts, but it's certainly a factor. And MI5, I think, were the first people to say so some years ago now, actually. Evans says so explicitly now. He says, of course, cautiously, I don't want to get involved in the rights and wrongs of the Gaza invasion by Israel and so on, which he says is, you know, a very complex issue, blah, blah, blah. But he says that nevertheless it could be seized on by those who want to cultivate, or Al-Qaeda sympathizers, let's put it that way, to use that as ammunition to recruit more militants, if you like.
Richard Norton Taylor. And there's full coverage of that story today at guardian.co.uk/UK. Also on The Guardian's website, Stephen Brook on who gets what in celebrity reality TV shows. Find out at guardian.co.uk/media. Marcel Berlins considers boring teachers. Have your say, guardian.co.uk/education. And John Henley interviews Ken Hom. He's the man who popularised Chinese cookery in the West. guardian.co.uk/food. Israeli shelling killed dozens of people yesterday at a United Nations school in Gaza. More than 40 people were reportedly killed in and around the school, which was being used as a shelter. The UN has called for an investigation. And in a separate airstrike on Gaza City, 12 members of the same family were killed. But though the numbers of children and civilians killed are rising dramatically, Middle East editor Ian Black says Israel is unlikely to bow to international pressure for a ceasefire.
The impression I have is that the Israelis still think that they can carry on for some time. They've rejected calls for a ceasefire, and they're insisting really flatly that the only way this thing can stop is for an arrangement to be put in place that will stop Hamas rearming at the end of the fighting. The example that they fear and what they're trying to avoid is the situation with Lebanon, with Hezbollah in Lebanon in 2006, when the war went on for over a month. And at the end of it, basically, Hezbollah, who they'd been fighting, was able to rearm fairly quickly, more or less wiping out any of the gains made in the war. Now, the Israelis have been more modest in their goals this time in the operation in the Gaza Strip against Hamas. They haven't said that they're trying to overthrow it, and they haven't said that they're trying to stop all attacks, but they are saying very clearly now that they must have something that will stop Hamas rearming. And that involves quite a complex diplomatic arrangement that needs to be put in place. And of course, that will take time to organise. And meanwhile, the fighting has been going on.
Nicolas Sarkozy has been in Syria trying to use Syria's influence to on Hamas to stop Hamas firing rockets into Israel. Is that particular diplomatic avenue likely to produce a result?
Well, I think Sarkozy has got the right idea. Syria is a very important country in this. It's the only Arab country that really supports Hamas to the hilt. Most of the others don't like it there. It's an Islamist movement. They think it's irresponsible. They support the Palestinian Authority, which runs the West Bank, which is generally recognized also by the West and has been negotiating with Israel. Syria, an important Arab country, backs Hamas. Sarkozy has gone to Damascus in the full knowledge that if there is an outside player, on the Arab side at least, that can do anything, it is Syria. Hamas has its main offices, its headquarters, if you like, in Damascus. But having said that, it's not clear that even Syria can stop this happening. It can talk, it can influence, it can perhaps apply some sort of pressure, but the danger is that this thing is taking on a dynamic of its own, if you like. Then all diplomacy, never mind just Sarkozy and the Syrians, but everybody else's efforts are being outstripped by the pace of what's happening on the ground.
President Bush has so far viewed the conflict purely in terms of Israel's legitimate right to defend itself against rocket attacks. In a couple of weeks' time, of course, we'll have a new president in Washington. Is America's position likely to change?
Well, it's obviously a significant part of this whole story that Barack Obama has not spoken out on it, and he's come under tremendous pressure to do so, and he's sticking to his guns. He's making his point there can only be one American president at one time. Of course, whatever happens between now and January the 20th, and people must hope that it will end by then, Obama will enter the Oval Office with the, if you like, the kind of smoking ruins of the Gaza Strip on his desk, commanding his most urgent attention. That is certain, clearly. However this operation ends, it will have served as a bloody reminder of how urgent it is to try to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, which, of course, Bush never tried to do.
Ian Black. My name's John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily. I don't know about you, but it's blooming freezing here at The Guardian, but not as cold as it is in Somerset.
We accidentally skidded on the ice, took out a few fence posts, farmer's field, where he wasn't very happy.
But first, the Russian energy company Gazprom has cut its supply of gas to Europe via Ukraine to about a quarter of normal flows. Bulgaria, Croatia, the Czech Republic, Romania and Turkey have all been affected by a row between Russia and Ukraine. Kiev accused Moscow of manipulating gas distribution, and Moscow retaliated by raising the price. The EU depends on Russia for about a quarter of its total gas supplies, and about 80% of that is pumped through Ukraine. Luke Harding is in Moscow for The Guardian. He explains how severely EU gas supplies have been cut.
Well, it's been nothing short of disastrous for European gas supplies. As of yesterday, Tuesday, we've seen an absolute kind of dramatic reduction in supplies to at least six European countries, including Bulgaria, Romania, Croatia, and several other countries as well that have been badly affected. At the same time, the volume of gas heading in the other direction towards Poland, Germany, and the Czech Republic has also been hit. And really, there's a kind of bitter blame game going on, with Ukraine saying that this has happened because Russia has, Gazprom, the state energy company, has simply stopped supplying gas to Europe, and that the volume of gas has fallen by 80%. Gazprom counters by saying that this is rubbish, and says that the Ukrainians shut down three out of four pipelines on Tuesday, in effect virtually kind of halting the transit supply of gas to Western Europe. Now it's impossible to know which side one believes in this dispute, but the fact is that the gas simply isn't arriving.
Although this row is ostensibly about unpaid bills and price levels, what's really behind it?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, this is a row being played out on several different levels. And actually, to be honest, it's not new that Ukraine and Russia have been having this kind of Christmas sort of time gas argument since the early 90s, when Ukraine first became an independent state. And it's made far more complicated by the fact that most of the sort of gas infrastructure, the pipelines, the storage facilities, lies inside Ukraine. So while Russia has all the gas, you know, from Siberia mainly, which everyone wants, the Ukrainians actually have a fairly, you know, strong bargaining position, because first of all, they can turn off the pipelines if they want to. And secondly, the storage facilities all lie in Ukraine. And now what the Ukrainians have done rather cleverly is to stockpile a fantastic amount of Russian gas, which means that they can actually survive this war. No one is going to kind of freeze to death on the streets of Kiev. And essentially, of course, what they want is they want cheaper gas. They want a better deal from Russia that they're currently being offered.
Are you suggesting, Luke, that they might ultimately get a better deal?
Well, I think that's possibly inevitable, because at the moment, 80% of European Union gas comes via Ukraine. Now, what happens if this dispute isn't resolved soon is that, of course, the European Union increasingly panics. People are worried that they won't be able to sort of make a cup of tea. And also, Gazprom doesn't get paid. It's got long-term contracts with most European Union countries. And obviously, that they are predicated on Gazprom being able to kind of deliver gas to European households, which currently isn't happening. At the same time, things politically in Kiev are very complicated. There's a kind of power game going on between Viktor Yushchenko, the president, and Yulia Tymoshenko, the prime minister. These two fell out really in the middle of last year. And at the moment, there's a sort of game of brinksmanship going on, because each wants to claim credit for solving this row, which means at the moment that neither of them are solving it.
Presumably, Luke, the contract between Ukraine and Gazprom is not very straightforward. It's presumably quite a complex matter unpicking such a thing.
It's extremely murky, and it's been a source of mystery for some time, really. The gas being supplied by Russia to Ukraine and to most of Europe is being supplied via an intermediary firm called Rosyuk Energo, which is registered in Switzerland, and its ownership structure is unclear. It's not entirely clear who actually owns it, who's behind it. I think this is another important element in this row, that there are huge interests, both within the Kremlin, within different factions of Gazprom, and within the Ukrainian leadership, who have a kind of vested interest in this business carrying on, but also have a vested interest in lining their pockets. And I think behind the scenes, this is an important factor in this ongoing war.
Luke Harding in Moscow. A message doubting the existence of God can be seen on the sides of buses, on the London Underground, and on billboard screens in central London. It reads, "There's probably no God. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life." Well, now 200 bendy buses in London and 600 further buses across England, Scotland and Wales will carry the slogan after a fundraising drive which raised more than £140,000. The Atheist Bus Campaign began life with a blog on The Guardian's website by comedy writer Ariane Shireen. Well, launching the campaign in Kensington yesterday, she said atheist ads would counter the more common religious slogans that threaten non-Christians with hell and damnation.
As of today, we've got 800 buses with the atheist advert running across the UK, from Glasgow to Aberdeen to Devon, Manchester, York, Leeds, all across the country. We've also got 1,000 brand new adverts on the Tube network from Monday, and we're going to unveil the 4 adverts today. And we've also got 2 large animated screens showing the advert on Oxford Street.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince, and I suppose I'm one of those traditional ranting atheist comedians that have sprung up around the country. Well, it's magnificent. It's just hundreds of TV crews, and by hundreds I mean 7, I think. What we have is a large, proper double-decker bus, not a route master, which would be a marvellous thing to see, obviously, but Boris Johnson hasn't managed to get to work yet, with a not quite lurid, but a vivid purple wording of "There's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life." I suppose we're at a very early stage before we know if it has achieved anything. But I think what it will do is it is going to achieve discussion. There will be people who immediately are affronted by this, it will be ridiculous. I have looked on the internet and there are people going, oh, terrible that these things should happen. And you think, well, not really, because as an atheist, I don't feel that I have to go and stand with a placard outside a church service on a Sunday. I don't feel affronted by people going every Sunday to do that. I don't feel affronted by going past Baptist churches or Anglican churches or Unitarian churches with their big signs about Jesus out the front. So this is merely the alternative opinion. And of course, it's not actually an atheist bus. I suppose technically it's an agnostic bus, because it's only "there's probably no God." It's slightly different in Britain to it is in, say, for instance, the United States of America, where there is a sense of worry about being an atheist. I think we live, hopefully, in a liberal enough country where there will be some lunatic fundamentalists who will start spouting off. As we know, there was a man called Stephen Green who runs a group called Christian Voice, who, upon hearing about the buses, went, "I don't think people like being preached to," which was quite an ironic comment from a man who spent so long campaigning against Jerry Springer, the opera.
I'm Richard Dawkins. I was delighted by the response to the campaign in the sense of financial contributions. £135,000, all raised in, not all, but most of it raised in small contributions, £5 here, £10 there, £20 there. I think that's an amazing statement that's being made about a mood in this country. It is a most astonishing thing that if you say something religious, that's fine. But if you say something much milder that's non-religious, you're strident and shrill. We are not strident and shrill. We are just saying perfectly reasonable things. In this particular case, we're saying, think for yourself. That's all we're saying. It's not strident and shrill.
Richard Dawkins. God bless that man. Now, if you live in the UK, it may not have escaped your notice that it's very, very cold. Temperatures are as low as minus 10 in some parts of the country. Tens of thousands of motorists were stranded across Britain yesterday. In central London, the fountains in Trafalgar Square were frozen. And at a school in Gloucestershire, burst pipes flooded a classroom, caused the staff room ceiling to collapse. One of the coldest areas of the country at the moment is Somerset in the southwest, from where Stephen Morris reports.
I'm in the Somerset village of Chewton Mendip. It's already minus 2 here. The sun's just gone down a few moments ago, and I'm crunching through the ice near the church. I'm going to go and talk to a few people here. They think this might be one of the coldest places in Britain overnight. Certainly this morning it went down to minus 10 here, the locals have told me. I'm going to go and have a look in the village stores and see how people are coping, how people are keeping warm here.
Hello, yes, my name's Peter and I'm the new owner of Chewton Mendip Stores, Linda's Loaf Organic Bakery. We're doing locally made pasties, Cornish pasties, either hot or cold, but at the moment mainly hot pasties because obviously of the extreme weather conditions.
I see you've got a sign outside saying hot food.
Hot food to go, yes. So obviously the passing trade are pulling in and they're buying our produce and off they go with it on their way to work.
And they're going well today on this, which could be the coldest day we've had for a while.
They are going extremely well, yes.
And how are you enjoying this cold weather?
Not very much. I've got an electric blanket for Christmas, so I'm okay, really. Not too cold.
So how many layers have you got on today?
I think I've got about four jackets on. Four jackets, yeah.
Four
and
jackets?
A coat and a scarf. And I'm in a shop, so I should be pretty warm, really, yeah.
You should be warm. You should be warm like that. And you've had a bit of a skid on the ice, I believe.
Yeah, my boyfriend, when we were coming back to my house, we accidentally skidded on the ice, took out a few fence posts, farmer's field. Well, he wasn't very happy, but we had to pay it off, and my boyfriend's car was right off.
So that was the village stores, lots of pasties being eaten, lots of soup being eaten, quite a few cups of coffee. But I've just spotted down the road somebody who could be the toughest man in Somerset by the look of him. He's a thatcher. It's almost dark. He's still working. He's looking very strong and very tough, and he's got no gloves on despite this, despite the temperatures, which are still dropping, maybe about -4 now. I'll go and find out how he copes with the cold.
Well, yeah, it's nice when the sun comes up, but it's I've had worse winters, but it's not bad actually. It's tough on the hands, but you can warm cup of coffee and you can keep going. You know,
you don't wear gloves?
No, not at all. No, you can't get a feel for the job.
So you have to have bare hands.
Bare hands and just grin and bear it, yeah. And feet as well. Your feet get cold as well, so.
Stephen Morris reporting. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Peter Sale and Andy Duckworth. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.